Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Dave Hoekstra, welcome to this week's edition of Nocturnal Journal here on WGN, and we are honored to have the court jester of world music, Mr. Jimmy Buffett, here to join us in the studio tonight. So thanks for coming in.
Well, it's great to see you having a steady job.
Yeah, it's a change. It is a change. So how you been?
We're rolling along. We're ending just about the end of summer tour, which has gone so fast I can't believe it. It's been a lot of fun. So we finish up at Alpine Valley. And then we got a long break, and then before we go do our little annual trip to Paris at the end of September, do a couple of shows there. And then we have a West Coast run in middle or the end of October. But this year's kind of fun because we put some other dates in there, places we hadn't played in a while. We're kind of doing that now with fun. We're playing the Hollywood Bowl for the first time in 17 years. So that's good. And then we Santa Barbara Bowl, Hollywood Bowl, Vegas, Albuquerque, which we hadn't been to since I was like 6 years old, and Irvine Meadows, which is about to close. So we got a few little things left to do, but for the majority of the summer tour is that part of it, since 1st of April will be done in Alpine Valley pretty quick.
You're doing the Barclays Center on New Year's Eve?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I don't know. They made me an offer I couldn't refuse. Normally, I'm playing in St. Bart's for a couple of free bottles of rosé. So, you know what? It was some other people had done it, and it had turned into like this over the past couple of years. I was unbeknownst to me for a while that it was like a big New York New Year's party, because I think McCartney did it, and Billy Joel did it, and somebody else did it. So we're doing it. Huey Lewis is opening. He's been opening this tour for us. Huey's great, you know. Yeah. So it came up, and I thought, you know, instead of hanging out at my local bar in St. Bart's, I'll go up and put some shekels in the kitty and have a good time and play a New Year's in New York. And I guess, I don't know the details, but there's some part about the, where does the ball come down now?
Is it still Times Square? Yeah.
I think somebody bought the ball and put it somewhere. Yeah, anybody, you got any kind of crack staff?
We'll try to figure that out.
No, but it used to be Times Square and go down, but it's something weird, I think, about it. But they want us to do to synchronize that where I do a song around midnight. So for that cool. Yes, I'm just going for a day or two. I think it'd be a fun show, and it's like, people are making New Year's plans to go to New York. I mean, I think it's sold out. The other thing is that I've heard that venue is really a good venue to play in.
Yeah. I've seen a basketball game there, but I haven't seen the music there.
But people that have played it have, you know how within the trade we know the rooms that sound good and the ones that try your patience. And I've heard nothing but good things about it.
What's it been like? I've known you for like over 30 years, but what's it been like to take your music on a global reach and stuff? You've taken, Paris, but you've gone to Anguilla. Do you have plans to go to Cuba? What's it like when you take your music out to other places?
Yes. You know what? Because it's the point where I'm not going over there the way you would think. And, you know, when I first started out, we knew each other in the early days. It was expensive to go. I couldn't afford to go overseas. I remember the first time that I was actually going to go overseas was when I was opening for the Eagles. And I think 77 when I opened the Hotel California tour.
Yeah.
And they asked me to go, but I couldn't afford to go. I would have spent all the money that I had made opening for them in the States going to Japan. So I didn't go. And that was just an economic thing. But it was, you know, even before social media kind of came into being, the old Coconut Telegraph was alive with people that knew about us. And I think a lot of it had to do the little bit of international stuff that we did. Canada was obvious. You know, we had a pretty decent Canadian following. But living in the French West Indies for as long as I have in the winter, I think the St. Bart's connection became a lot of people who went there who had a connection either to Paris or Montreal, places like that, the word kind of got around. So we had a very eclectic, like club-based following. So I'm basically a club performer. Come on, going to play Paris in a club, who would want to do that? Yeah. So that's how it started in France. And then from there, what happened was when we did it the first time, we played the New Morning, a little club, probably 6 or 7 years ago. And I had set my goal there to say, I want to play the Olympia before I'm done with all this, because the Olympia is just one of those rooms you want to play. And of course, everybody said, well, nobody knows who you are there. And I said, well, let me handle that. And so long story short, we played, and interestingly enough, we didn't have a lot of Parisians there, but they were diehards, the ones who were there. A lot of Americans came, a lot of Irish and a lot of English and Scots came, a lot of Italians, and a lot of people from like Holland, Norway. So yeah, in Europe, it's easy to get to. They actually have a good mass transportation system.
Yeah, yeah.
And so everybody was like, it was Paris became the vacation town for parrot heads, the few there were around Europe, and they congregated there. So when we go over this town, we play two nights at La Cigale to 5,000 people. I could go bigger, but why? This is a very special gig. So now with Margaritaville TV, we can do those shows and let other people see them who can't get there. So that's the way it's kind of headed there. And then the other place where we have a big overseas following is Australia. Right. And that came out of boats and surfing, totally, because I went down there and did it. And it's a beach country as a whole. So it was very easy to do there. So that's the place we've gone. But now it's a lot of fun to go. And like the other day, I was I took a couple weeks off, and I went with my wife and one of my daughters. We went to Greece for the first time, right in the middle of the Greek crisis.
Yeah.
I figured time, it'd be like Monopoly. It'd be like you could buy a Greek island for what Baltic and Mediterranean used to cost.
Yeah.
maybe 60 euros or something. So we went, but on the way, I'd always, because I fly over there myself and I stop and get fuel, so I always stop at this place in Ireland called Dromoland Castle where I play golf, and it's got a really nice restaurant. You get fuel, you break the trip up. And I went in and I could hear this guy, and he was singing like a great voice of Irish sea chanties. So I went and had a couple of good scotches at the bar, and I was listening. And then some guy came up who was a parrot head with his – he was from Hawaii. His wife was Irish. Their daughter, which had just graduated from high school, magna cum laude, was going to Washington Lee on a scholarship. And they were just happened to be in. And then so a couple of scotches. And I said, well, y'all are such good fans. You want to hear anything? So I went up and asked the guy if I could borrow the guitar. So I just played in this Irish bar for like 11 people. And then I went on to Greece. So that's the fun stuff to do. And now, again, with the concept of making big shows out of little shows, we can do that like that and have a lot of fun and go back to playing bars. But then, we do surprisingly big numbers of people that watch the big show. Like last night, I just got them today, and we played Camden, New Jersey outside of Philly last night. So we sold it out, so it's probably 19, 20, 21,000 people there. And we had 28,000 people listening online, watching online. And so it's real interesting that you're double. And then this year we did 30 shows, which we broadcast, streamed live and free. And we had an audience of just a little over 340,000 people. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, people can find that at
MargaritavilleTV.com.
Yeah, right.
So, we're past even the critical stage. I mean, we're humming along now, but it's very, very free flow and open. You could come on.
Yeah.
So what it does, that again has been like the worldwide connection now is at that level, because people listen all over the world or watch that show all over the world now. So, and it's still free. So I have no plans to charge for it, because, we sell everybody a lot of this stuff and they buy it. So why would I charge them for this,
I've always written in the past about the global nature of your band. Can you talk about how you've assembled the band and some of the key players? I mean, we've talked, Robert Greenidge and Ralph, when Ralph was in the band. And
well, it goes from the music, I think, that you listen to. If I go back to my musical history, which I know you're kind of aware of, too, is You know, I came out of the Gulf Coast. I played, worked my way through school playing in bars in Biloxi, Mississippi. And at that point, you know, the golden ticket was to be playing on Bourbon Street in New Orleans, which I made. So I made it that far. But then at the same time, then, you know, my musical roots were based in New Orleans rhythm and blues, which I still is one of my favorite musics. Then because I didn't have enough money to get to California to get a job offer, I went to Nashville instead. So then they were trying to peg me as a country singer, but I really wasn't one. And I was older country music at the time. I really love, you know, new country music. I'm not so hip on, you know, but at that time, I never thought of myself as a country singer because I was such an R&B, New Orleans R&B guy. So that, and when I got a band, I kept that aspect to it, though, some of the songs. But then I'd throw a steel guitar in like Doyle Gresham, and then all of a sudden, through Ralph McDonald and Elliot Shiner, I meet Robert Greenwich, who's been, again, like with me for almost as long as I've known you. And he's just one of the masters of the steel drums. And then you get Ralph McDonald, God rest his soul, who was like the ultimate percussionist ever. And those guys were looking for a fun band to be in because they were top session players. But they were also, they started as road dogs. And, you know, there's that, if you're a nomad, you're a nomad and you know it early, you know. And but they had had a lot of success doing studio work and all. So they were happy to get back in the band, and I was happy to have them. And then with Michael Utley and Mac McAnally stirring the pot there of kind of keeping it all together. And, you know, nobody has to play up to what they're capable of playing in this band because the guy who writes the songs is not – they're pretty simple songs, you know. But it's an amazing thing for me every night to sit up there and listen to this band and I know how good this band is. I'm very proud of that. And I think the way we do our show is it's like the other night, you know, and we still play live and we still, you know, it's fun and we, you know, it's working the material now and figuring out what to go up there because now Parrot Heads have so much access to tell you what they want to hear. To the tune that, like this year, we started out by just saying, okay, go write the set list. And we did the set list show, which is what this tour is kind of based on. And we did that show in Key West where, yeah. And we had 85,000 people submitted a set list. I mean, I thought if 10,000 people took the time to do it, that would be good. But that's how dedicated everybody is out there. And just the fact that you can, so they can feel that they have a say-so in what's being played up there. I didn't realize how much that meant to people. I had to discover that.
What were their popular requests? What were the ones that came over and over again?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a break. I'd like to talk a little about Harry Belafonte when we get back.
Cool.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right, we'll be back with more Nocturnal Journal with Mr. Jimmy
Nocturnal
Buffett after
Journal.
This.
I like it.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal here on WGN with Jimmy Buffett. That was a little bit of our hero there, Harry Belafonte.
Our mutual hero.
Yeah, yeah.
Harry.
Tell me how Harry, I mean, you and I have talked about him before, but in your own words, what was the influence?
Well, the influence was, you know, when I was growing up, it was before, 45s were just coming out, so you had to listen to the music that your parents had when they had 78s or albums. So, fortunately, my mother had a broad range of things that she loved, and Harry Belafonte was one of her favorite artists, too. And the other thing was that my grandfather, who was a ship captain at the time, and his route after the war was New Orleans to Rio de Janeiro and through Trinidad. So he was a calypso. He loved calypso music. I mean, he was from Canada originally. Where the connection is, you don't know, but he loved it. So I remember listening to early calypso before I ever heard Harry Belafonte. So when I heard Harry Belafonte, when he first started coming out, it wasn't like the first time I'd heard it, though those were the first songs of his I'd heard. It was just the groove was so much fun. It had been stuff that my grandfather would play like at parties when I was a kid.
That's a core part of your DNA, your musical DNA. I mean, you hear it.
Yeah.
Not only calypso, but the folk approach.
And, well, that's what it is, yeah. You know, and there's so much. And then, You know, I knew I was destined to spend a lot of time in the Caribbean because of that, and I figured I'd either be a boat captain, or if this thing didn't work out, I could own a bar and play guitar and do a charter boat. It wasn't so bad, you know. I could have been Captain Ron. But it worked out. So it was between that and then traveling around and listening, because the thing of it is that everybody thought of Calypso as kind of the only kind of music, which is, you know, that's what Harry did. And but there's so many different kinds, you know. You go island to island and it just changes. It's from Zouk and Merengue and the French islands to, you know, kind of voodoo-inspired stuff from Haiti and Cuban to... so there's so much down there. And I loved it all. It was just a natural way, like it is today. What I listen to today is I listen to a lot of West African stuff. You know, when people ask me what I'm listening to, I listen to a lot of... Now, I mean, I'm on, like, music service channels, but then you can pick what you want. But it's still my same genres would be a Calypso channel and that West African channel and some Gordon Lightfoot, some folkies, you know? Yeah. So that hadn't changed a lot, though I don't stay there and I listen to, you know, other new stuff. But all that Caribbean stuff came out of that to New Orleans, and then... I always wanted to have those kind of players in a band. And White Sport Coat, we had congas on that and a percussionist, you know. And so we started there, and that were session players then, because I didn't have a band at that time. So when we were able to form the band, and then when I got to Key West and listening to all the music that would come out of, because I'd listen to the radio from the Bahamas and from Cuba and things like that, and then Bob Marley comes up. So once Bob Marley hit the scene, I mean, reggae was my groove. Uh-huh. Yeah. It still is.
When you were, you know, we did it. We had Charlie McCoy on the show not long ago,
yes.
And we were talking about that Nashville Cats thing, and we were talking about Norbert Putnam and stuff.
Yeah.
When you were trying to do this music in Nashville in that period, what was the response like with the Nashville
None.
Establishment? Yeah, right.
None.
Yeah, yeah. It was so different.
Charlie McCoy is like the lead. I have to say, not none, but the fact of it was that the way I got to Nashville, that the guy who was the top steel player at the time was a guy named Lloyd Green, and he was from Mobile. And the guy who took me to Nashville was a guy named Milton Brown to record. And Milton was a song. Well, he owned a furniture store, but he wanted to be a songwriter, so he had one foot in the door of country music, and he loved those. Family hated it. He had a little studio in Mobile, so I went in and recorded some stuff just to sell in this bar I was working at. So he said, this is really good. So if you come up, I usually have, like, I'm going to do these demos. I've got some time at the end, so I'll just let you have that time at the end. And it was a group of musicians. And Henry Schreckley was the drummer. Carl Hemmer was the drummer. Henry Schreckley was on bass. And Lloyd Green was on steel, and I can't think of the guitar player's name, but they were the rhythm section. So when I played it, Lloyd Green went, that is good stuff. So he was just a player, but everybody's looking, and he got the attention of Buzz Kasson. Yeah. Long story short, that's where I wound up working up there. But still trying. And the ironic thing was, when I got to Nashville, because I'd worked all the years through school, I had put myself through school working in bands. And so I thought, I'll get to Nashville, the music city of the world. I'm like, I got no problem getting a job here. I'll just go to any bar here, audition. I know I'm good. I can get in here, and I'll find myself work here. There was no live music in bars in Nashville.
And period, what year would this have been, roughly?
1973. There were country copy bands down around the Opry, but there was no other thing going on. But there was a whole group of younger, hipper people who were not, you couldn't get recorded there, because if you were on the fringe, you were straight ahead country. You know, you had to fit that radio mold. But there were still a lot of people down there, like John Hyatt I met there. John Hyatt was a guitar player on my first recording sessions down there. And he wound up being in a band called White Duck. And there were a couple of guys who were on the edgy, and so I kind of got in with them. But in the establishment of Nashville, you know, I want to try to get a job as a background singer. I couldn't. It was so tiered and so closed. And then you had no place to go make a living as a performer. And that's what drove me to get a job at Billboard.
Yeah.
I mean, I looked around because I had to get work, and I literally answered an ad in the Nashville Banner for a guy with a journalism degree. The next thing I knew, I was working for Billboard.
This is, we got to watch out because we could talk about journalism all night. But I mean, what was that like? Working for Billboard?
Well, I went from being rejected and knocking on doors. I mean, not even trying to get a record deal, trying to plug songs, to getting free records from record companies, and now people let me in because they wanted me to write stories about them.
Yeah.
And I did use that to my advantage.
Now, I know, how many books have you done?
Six or seven.
Are you working on a new book?
I am. You know, I've been trying to get one out for a while, but then, you know, other things came along, and I'm back on it now. And then the whole book world changed, and so, but I think it changed into my favor. You know, people seem to want shorter books about interesting subjects, and you can do interactive stuff with it. So I'm working on something right now that's pretty cool. I think you'll like it.
Can you say where it's set? That's the only question I'd ask.
What it is?
Yeah,
well, it's a collection of a couple of new travel stories. I tried to put it all together as a big book, and it was too much work. But I got a lot of stuff there, so I found a friend of mine who also happened. She worked at Little Brown when I used to publish there, and so I got out of the traditional record business. I got out of the traditional publishing business. So I said, Mailboat Publishing is going to go publish this book, and we'll go direct to retailer to Amazon. It's just simple. At the other time, I went back and read Tales from Margaritaville myself, just to own it and have it. So, you know, we're doing stuff like that. That'll come out first. And the first one I did was The Swamp Creature Let One In, the golf story. So I went out at night, and I had my little setup, and I had a couple glasses of wine, and I read it, unabridged. You know, I remember the time my dog's out barking, and she wants to come in and chase the ball. So she's like in the, and it's videoed and it's audio. Okay. So it gave me this idea that that's what people like. And the other thing is, in that collection were all the liner notes that I'd written. And I started thinking about that, and my editor, and I said, you know, these are great stories in here, and they kind of conjure up. And then I'd also write about when I wrote certain songs, how they came about. So all of a sudden, that's a whole collection of stuff now. So that's going to be a part of it, and we're just going to interface that with a little, you know, kind of some enhanced stuff like recordings or videos and things. That's what's going to be.
Obvious question. I mean, what is the different discipline in writing a song and writing a short story?
It's much harder to write a short story than to write a book. Yeah. Much harder. I don't see how people – I understand why people die and become drug addicts or alcoholics about it, because it's a very lonely thing to do. And it takes a lot of – you spend a lot of time by yourself. I used to go out in the middle of writing a book. I'd run down to the bar and play just to hear – because I'm a shameless performer, and I need that applause, you know. And most people that write a book don't know whether it's going to be successful not until it comes out.
It's very true.
Well, I knew I could do something else pretty well, so I didn't have that fear. But it's still – It's a lot of discipline, and working with Herman Wolk was an invaluable experience to me, because he gave me one great piece of advice. He said, just get one page a day. He said, you know, don't worry about anything else. You know, don't try to get far. He said, but if you get one good page a day, just do the math. In 30 days, you'll have 30 pages.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We'll be back with more. You want to talk about Chicago when we get back?
Da, da, da. Yeah.
Okay, we're back with more Jimmy Buffett here on Nocturnal Journal. Don't go away. Welcome back. That's what I'm talking about. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal here on WGN.
I was reminiscing there.
Jimmy Buffett and Steve Goodman. Tell me about that song and how that song came about with Steve Goodman.
Well, Mr. Goodman had a unique, probably unknown trait to him, that he was a voracious song plugger. You know, and I owed him dearly from years past, but he would, I'm pretty sure that he would know when I was recording, or we would be talking, I'd be going in, and he'd go, hey, you know, I got this thing. And the thing of it was, every time he did it, they were really great songs. And Banana Republic was one of them. And I think at the time he'd gone down to maybe Mexico somewhere on vacation. So, but by that time I figured he thought, yeah, this would work for me, for Jimmy. And so he came back and he played it for me. Of course, I went, yeah, I'll take it. And then the other ones were like, Where's the Party? Same thing. He came and brought me that. Hotel Room. They just, you know, that I heard Hotel Room when he did it at the Earl, and I just, you know, we all lived in those kinds of places back then, and always looking for humorous material. That one, and then
Frank and Lola,
and then California Promises, which was the last thing I think that he plugged in. He was living in California by then.
Yeah, yeah.
So you look back at all those songs, they were always, he'd always get one to me. Yeah, when he knew I was going in to record, and I usually did them.
You told me once that Chicago was the scene of your first major success and stuff. What did you learn?
Out of the South, yeah,
out of the South. What did you learn here?
A lot. It was just, you know, you get comfortable in one place for too long to an audience. And I kind of developed this band, and I realized that, you know, my natural kind of talent was not toward, I wanted to be a better guitar player because you looked at the people I idolized, George Harrison or Clapton or people at that time. But it takes, you know, there's 10,000 hours in there. And I went, you know, and you had to get on the stage to figure it out. But I was always leaning to running the band and being the front man and being the entertainer. And I knew that that's, you know, what I did best. And so I could hire other people at times. So I did that, and we were pretty successful in the New Orleans market for a while. And then band broke up. Things happened. And then I was kind of just, you know, stabbing around for a long time. And out of Nashville, my manager, Don Light, at the time, had these showcases. And Richard Harding was one of the guys, because Don was one of those guys who was on the eclectic rim of Nashville talent. Because he had gospel guys, and then he had, like, John D. Loudermilk was the guy that I loved that he represented. There was a great guy, songwriter then, and an old kind of folk, Billy Ed Wheeler. And so he had these kind of guys around. And so they came to the showcase to more or less see them, and I was on the bill. And for whatever reason, Richard Harding took a liking to me and gave me a job at the Quiet Night. And it was the first time I came up here. And the cool thing in those days about it was, as the opening act, you'd come up here and you'd live in Chicago because you played for a month. And the headliners would change every week. So I remember the first time I came up here as an opening act, it was like Siegel Schwall Band, Dan Hicks and the Hot Licks, Neil Sedaka, and I think Jerry Jeff. And this was like 76. This is when Marley played Chicago the first time.
Yeah.
And so you'd stay the whole time. So you got to know the room, but you got to know a whole different audience and a whole different... Chicago's a big city. I mean, New Orleans is one thing, but Chicago... So the crowds are different. You got to go back and warm up, and they are not there to see you. I mean, I'd left an environment where which we had built an audience of people there to see us, but when you get take that next step, it's like you're going to the minor leagues again, and you're opening. And I was okay with it, but you really had to, you know, you had to kind of, you know, you were scared to death at first because, you know, if you're not any good, you know, at least I knew I had a month's work, you know, which was kind of good, but it was just having the opportunity there every night to play in a place that had such a reputation as that. If somebody is knowledgeable, is gracious, and with such an instinct as Richard had, not just the musicians that he, or the acts that he hired, but the people that worked there. And so he was like, you know, he was just, he took you in and he taught you stuff. And so he would tell me things about how to do the show.
And you listened to him.
And I listened to him. I think he tested me because, I mean, how do you go from opening from Neil Sedaka making a comeback to Dan Hicks in 2 weeks? And I had such a good time opening for Dan Hicks. And he would say, you know, that just went here. And I'm going, Neil Sedaka, what the hell am I going to do? And I went in on the first night. I'll never forget this. I don't think I've ever told this story. But I went and watched Neil Sedaka. And he was coming. It was a comeback. And he was the slickest New York, so he great songs, but it was just like this, it was the Brill Building. And what are you going to do? I mean, the guy's a legend. But the crowd scared me to death because it was like, it's like they bust them in from New Jersey. I mean, it was older kind of, and they were, you know, and I went, God almighty, what am I going to do? So I remember this girl, Chucky, who worked there, said, come on, let's go with me. We did the first show, and there was like, I was scared of people just, you know, just talking, nobody listening to me. So I had a couple of drinks, and we ran down to an old clothing store that she knew or ran, bought some 50s stuff, some Depp at the drugstore, went back, had a couple more drinks, got really drunk, and I did oldies.
Really?
And I did a 50s version of me. And I did Elvis and Conway Twitty and everything else. People went crazy. And Richard laughed. I mean, it was like, but he said, see, you could open for him. Yeah. And I went, yeah. He said, see, you found the way. And that was the lesson, you know. It's just like, so I learned so much from him by doing that. And then I eventually went on to headline there. And I always learned that when I would have opening acts out there, he was so gracious to me and the acts that were in there that you learn from those guys. And they were there because they'd been there. For the most part, people were there to teach you what they did. And if they liked you and you were good, they took you under their wing. And so that incubator of the quiet night was, again, also then I kind of got known around town, but I was just still a club player. But Goodman and Prime were like going up because Christopherson was doing their songs, and so they were up there like, yeah. And Bonnie Kolak too, and so that whole scene was going on. But Goodman, I think, came to see me there, and then I went over to see, invited me over to the Earl, and that's how that happened. Yeah. And then I wound up for years coming back here, but then got to that level where I was headlining as well in those clubs. You know, I never worked the Earl because I was loyal to Rich. Earl tried to hire me.
That's the thing. Those guys were such rock on tour. I mean, yeah. To explain in a historical sense, just with Earl and Richard, yeah. They were just really colorful characters.
Very, you know? Colorful characters.
I mean, we could even touch on Eddie Balchowski. I mean, you knew Eddie,
right.
The one-armed
and Eddie,
piano.
Who I wrote, he went to Paris about
yeah.
this.
Tell us about Eddie.
Well, he was the sweep-up guy, yeah. You know, in the quiet night. And he'd go in, and after the show, he played one-handed piano because he'd lost his hand in the Spanish Civil War fighting for the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. And he was kind of an on and off junkie and an artist, and, you know, just, but Richard had him in there. But he'd sit there and play these songs in Spanish at the end of the night. I mean, I'm getting goosebumps now thinking about just he's sitting there playing for me. And he liked me, and I was a kid, and I just, that seared an indelible lasting impression of a great character that I wanted to write about. And I wrote that song, you know, in the quiet night, like later in those years. And then he was in and out, and then he was gone for a while. Then, you know, because I'd say, where's Eddie? And Richard would go, he'll be back. But that kind of thing was going on back then. But they were all very loyal, and as were the people that came out of the Earl. You know, and the thing of it was the Quiet Night had a few bands like Siegel Schwald, a couple of local people played there, but not as many as went through. The Earl was like, these were local kids that had made it there. And I was a transient coming through, and I think that was the difference too. But, you know, I'd go over and jam at the Earl all the time, you know, but I never actually was hired to play there.
Did you have a cheeseburger there? I bet you had a cheeseburger.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. And then the room in the back. But those were just wonderful formative days of being a nomad traveling minstrel, and I loved it. And from there, I would base out of here, and I started working out west. And then I one of the great stories I've never told anybody about, this was like after City of New Orleans got recorded, and Goodman was making money. And I was living, I'd come up and stay with him and Jesse at the apartment. And I had a job in Denver, And we had gone out one night, and we went to some other bar that Earl had, and it was a crap game or a poker game, and we kind of all got drunk. I lost all my money in a poker game. And I had to go to the train station the next day to go to Denver, because I knew I could get to work. I could get some more money. And then I got to the station, and then I realized that, you know, I hadn't mentioned this to Goodman until I got to the station. I was at the train station in Chicago getting on the Union Pacific to go to Denver to get to work at the Cafe York, and I went, I know this sounds weird, I said, but I lost all my money last night in the game. I said, I don't have enough money to buy a ticket. Can you lend me some money? Without hesitation, he gave me $300.
Yeah.
I got on the train, and I went to work, and I paid him back when I got there.
And I've seen it with my own eyes. I mean, we brought Richard to that show at Toyota Park, and you've been so nice to your roots here. I mean, you've never forgotten those guys. You really haven't?
No. I mean, they were always a great part of it, and that's why I have such an affection for the city, because I learned it through the music. And then they took me to other places I would have never gotten. I mean, to blues clubs and to, you know, there was reggae bands going on around then. Yeah, that's when Marley hit here. I mean, nobody knew. I'd never seen a Rasta before Chicago.
Yeah.
So, you know, we said we'd never go back in those old days, but those were very, very formative years for me to come play. And then, you know, then I wound up playing the old Airy Crown Theater, and then we'd play the music hall down, and then it just kept going, you know. And then it was, the venue that was out west that we used to play, Poplar Creek. Poplar Creek.
Yeah.
So we were big at Poplar Creek.
Yeah, I remember
that. That's where it first hit. That's where one day we'd play there and there'd be 3,000 people. The next day there was 30.
Yeah, I saw you in 82 there with Bonnie Raitt. That's one of the first. Yeah.
And that's why Chicago and Cleveland were the first big cities after working all that time, you know, and you're working way up and you're a headliner and you're working the sheds and you're getting, you know, three to 5,000 people. You're making money, and now all of a sudden there's an opening act for you. And then one day they showed up.
Was that a tough jump for you? I mean, to go from clubs never asked you that. To go from clubs into big venues like that, or was it a slow organic process?
I thought it was going to be more of a jump, and I was scared of it a bit. I thought it'd be a bigger jump than it was, but no, because what I learned to do is just isolate. If you're, because what it was kind of the lighting. Itself kind of, you can't see everybody in a big room. And I remember the first times, and all I did was I kind of tried to work to people I could see like I was in a club. And then I realized, then I read, it was Huey P. Long and Hitler that taught me how to reach a large audience, because I read books about, you know, I read the T. Harry Williams book on, and there was a guy that did the microphones for Hitler. You know, about, you know, then they kept him in a vault, and it would fascinate me, but how projection and how, you know, how you work the crowd.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Those two, Huey Long and Hitler, were pretty good at it. You know?
On that note, we're going to take a break. Couple more segments.
I want to hear that. Oh, my God. Huey Long and Hitler.
We'll be back with more Nocturnal. I want to go back to Cuba and Easter Island. Maybe we'll kind of wrap it up a little bit. But thanks for being so generous with your time on a Saturday night.
Man, we're having fun.
We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal here on WGN with Jimmy Buffett. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Great.
You're two places
here
at once.
Yes, I can do that.
Yeah.
I'm not a hologram.
I love that. That's one of my favorite songs of yours. Tell us about that song.
Mine
Brian
too,
Wilson.
Yes. I wrote part of it. I had a great drummer who had a great run with us named Matt Benton. And he was also the big, when Jimmy Bowen went to Nashville and sort of took over that whole MCA thing, and actually was when that's how I got back there in my attempted third country career, I guess, was with Bowen. But he loved Matt, and he loved a couple other players, and Matt was his drummer. And Matt was a very kind of straight-up, stand-up guy, but he, again, was one of those guys. He was a great songwriter, but he could nail me. He could write stuff that I'd go, man, I wish I wrote that song. So he played me a couple of things earlier on, and other things. Apocalypso is one he did. One of my favorite songs is Breathe In, Breathe Out, Move On. So he'd send me these things, and then I'd what we always call buffetize them. There would be, you know, they'd be 70, 80% written, but then I'd, you know, melody-wise, I didn't mess with much, but I'd start messing with the story. And that, so Schoolboy Heart, was he brought that to me, and it was like we had I was such a Beach Boy fan, and then I had that opportunity to work with Brian at one time, and I think right after that we were talking about doing it. But, yeah, it's got that Beach Boy thing in there. We went Beach Boy on that thing. But and the thing of it is, too, it's one of my favorite songs to perform, and crowds love it, too.
Yeah, you know? It's got that great hook.
They do.
Yeah, it really, really does. I've been following your career for so long, and you were, and we talked about this during the break, you were so far ahead of the game and taking control of your own business.
Yeah.
And was that because, I mean, did you learn that in school? Why were you just so far ahead of all that? And you've kept, you know.
That really came out of the fact of the 2 years that I worked at Billboard when I had to get the job in Nashville. Again, purely accidental, you know, I had a journalism degree. I said I answered an ad in the Nashville Banner. It wasn't like today you go out and do an interview. You'd think Billboard would have looked elsewhere for somebody, then put an ad in the paper.
Yeah.
So one of the other great teachers that I had was a guy named Bill Williams, who was the editor of Billboard. He was a country editor. And I went to work for him, and he was just a likable guy. He also was the local weatherman, and he was, but he also, he was Billboard down there, so he knew, he was a great, great traditional journalist. He knew everybody in every place that ran that town, and they needed him because he was Billboard, and they wanted, and Billboard was the publication back then. So he brought me on board, and I just kind of did. I filled, there was another, they had Amusement Business Magazine, which was a fair business and stuff, and I'd carbon my stories to them. And I'd kind of look for little stories around town, and he'd send me on assignments and do things. And I had a great time doing it. Plus, it opened a number of doors. But the best part of it was, we'd go and we became very good friends, and his son was about my age, and about this time was Vietnam War was going on, so I'm working at Billboard, but I'm singing at anti-Vietnam rallies and in my friend's jacket and my coat in Nashville, you know, which was risky business in those days, you know. And so, but he loved me, and he was from Omaha, Nebraska originally. We'd sit down, have a few drinks, and he would tell me stories about how this music, he said, it is not what you think it is. And then he'd start giving me examples of people and how it really worked, that this was strictly a publishing town, and no matter what you do here, you're going to be always working for somebody. And even if you're smart or if you're not so smart, it doesn't matter, and doesn't work that way. It's a publishing control town, and artists are an disposable commodity. And you know, and I said, well, okay, but I still, you know, I'll do anything to get an album deal. And he says, well, that's exactly what I'm talking about. So it goes about and it happens. But knowing that at the time, and how, even when I went to do my first record deal, then I asked for my publishing, that I wanted to keep my publishing, if they were going to sign me to this, and I'd take less money if I kept my publishing. That was the first thing that he taught me to do. Of course, they said, forget it.
Yeah, right.
So I signed anyway. You know? And but it was what I learned from him when I went through the whole gauntlet of recording companies that, you know, I was with ABC until they got sold forever, and I never sued anybody. I committed to every contract I ever did. Uh-huh. I never got out of one. I renegotiated some. I never sued anybody. Never, you know, until the end, until I decided at that point that I knew. But I had enough going on to know how to make good deals when I finally got to the point where I could. And then I ran into Chris Blackwell at that time.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the next mentor to me on how to do this. You know, and he was where you wanted to be because he was an artist. He did not do business the way other record companies did, you know. I mean, Marley wound up, you know, what he did with Marley and what he did with U2 and when later they had problems. But he was an artist guy. And you wanted to be there. So
interesting, yeah.
I learned back then that whenever I got to the point where I could get control of everything, I mean, you got to be a control freak in the beginning because there's nobody else out there that wants to have anything to do with you.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
People say, oh, you're a control freak. Well, no kidding.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I've gotten better, but you have no choice in the beginning because there's the whole thing is stacked against you. So you had to do everything. You know, so Once I got to the point where I didn't have to do everything, I could negotiate a way into a better situation for me, because the other thing was I did not depend on them. Because what Bill told me at the time, because he had seen me perform and he'd come to my shows, he'd say, you know, the great card that you've got is the performing card, because that's your money and they can't take that from you. So you can make a living as an entertainer while you try to become a recording artist. And that's what I did. And it worked all the way up till now and beyond, to the point where the ironic thing is now that, you know, when Steve Jobs hoodwinked the record business into giving him the entire record business and destroying the album business, record companies didn't care about, you know, promoters did live performances. Record companies weren't involved. Now, you're trying to get somebody on the air so they get heard, so somebody will buy a ticket to the show, which is a complete 180-degree reversal, as you know, from the way it was. So I got through that to the point where I'm still one of the, you know, we're still, thank God for loyal fans, we're still one of the top grossing acts around there when we choose to go out. But it's still us. But in the meantime, everything else is falling into place. I now have the record company. I now have the publishing company. I now have the Margaritaville TV and Radio Margaritaville. Because it was about that, if you can keep it yourself. We started Radio Margaritaville. I went to Australia and I heard, you know, at that time there were only like 10 FM stations. It was pre-internet. But the way they programmed them, because it was a beach culture, one station had the greatest programs because they know where the people were. They'd have a headbanger night, you know, they'd have jazz on Sunday, but most of the day was Aussie bands and Kiwi bands and bands from the States which played beach music. Uh-huh. So they knew how to program. So once internet radio came about, I said, you know, we don't need to go try to get on the radio. Let's go make, we can have a station. And one to one, and so when we started it, you know, and it still is, Radio Margaret is still free on the internet.
Right.
And we made a deal a long time ago because it happened right here on the corner of Michigan and Dearborn. And I was going across after we'd first started doing it, and you could only get it on your computer. Uh-huh. And we started Radio Margaritaville maybe a year into it. I'm walking through traffic, and there's a guy coming the other way, and he said, Jimmy, how you doing? He said, it's great you're here. We can't get tickets. The shows are sold out, but we're taking our computer to the barbecue. And, they, you know, that time he'd, you know what he had to do? He had to run a long cord out there and put it out. But I went, man, once you can get this to the beach and you get it and it'll come in the future. And I started looking at how that was going to happen. Once it comes into play, the whole thing is going to change. And so the first thing it was Sirius Radio. And I went, you know, when they had that, I went, I got to get on this. And that's when they said, make the deal, but you got to give up Radio Margaritaville for free on the internet. I said, I'm not doing it if you don't do that. I said, don't you understand? If people are listening and that loyal, first thing they're going to say is you sold out. Second thing they're going to say, but to you, if you're that way, once it gets, you've got satellite technology to take this to the beach, to the boats. I was, you know how many boats are have a tape of mine on them?
Yeah, right.
I said, you know, they're going to buy one anyway, and they're going to be happy to buy it. And they're not going to be dissatisfied customers because you won't let them have it on. And so we're the only station up there that still has it for free.
What do you tell? I know you've been active in this. I mean, like the Taylor Swift. What do you tell young artists about maintaining, getting their royalties and maintaining control of their rights?
Well, you know,
you've gone to bat for that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in both of them. I mean, it's the thing of it is the world that we knew, if anybody my age or beyond, it, say, you know, whether anybody that made albums and got mechanicals and got publishing money, the inflow of money that came in off of a disc full of 12 songs. It's over. It is done, and the way you made your money is done. And technology did it, you know. And technology would have taken it anyway, but a few stupid record guys made it happen quicker, in my humble opinion. And so once technology got control of catalogs, that you know, it's like a battleship and mothballs. You can have 16 six-inch guns, but Nobody needs it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what the model of the record business was. So what is available today by music service companies and the way you can still find your following, and then people sell a few albums out there, but it's completely different. But it's a younger generation's format, so I have no problem with it. I mean, you know, people that are older and were making money the other way and they're making money this way, it's less. So they're angry and they're bitter and they fight it, but you're fighting the finger in the dike, you know. It's not, and you know, if you don't figure out a way to be an artist, if you're an older artist trying to figure out to do it, you got to either go be a good touring artist, you've got to figure out a way to do it differently. And you know, it's just finding another channel you're just trying to get to the public, you know. If you look long and hard enough, and if you care about what you're doing, you can find. I think in a way it's easier and it's better because you can start out, and if you've got 10 people who are listening to you, they go on Facebook, then there's 600 people who know who you are like that. But the problem of it is it's so available. There's so much bad stuff up there.
Yeah.
Weeding through it. But the system itself, I think, if you're good enough and you work it and you still go out and do the basic thing, you can't do it without having talent.
It kind of parallels,
I don't say that because a lot of people don't have talent, make it. But if you want to be successful and last a long time and not kill yourself or burn out, you got to be smart and have a little talent, good luck, and some work ethic.
In a way, it kind of parallels what happened to, you know, journalism. I mean, there's a lot of different websites.
Yeah, the same thing.
We're going to take a break, and then we'll come back with one more segment. I saw Mike Ramos out there. We got to let you go.
Okay.
Don't go away on Nocturnal Journal after this. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal here on WGN AM 720. We're here with Jimmy Buffett. Thank you so much for spending some time with quality time with us tonight.
Well, you're a good person to spend quality time with, Dave.
Well, thank you. Thanks a lot. And you know, I tried to be well researched. I was going through some of my old notes
I
with
look
you.
At those, yeah.
Yeah. And so, tell us about your history. You're no newcomer to Havana. Tell us about your family history.
It's interesting what's happening now, but. My fascination started early because my grandfather was a sailing ship captain, and he was one of his ports of call was there. He would load, I believe, lumber from Pascagoula, and he'd take lumber throughout the Caribbean, and he'd bring salt back up, but his stops were like Havana, Salt Key, Martinique, and down there. So in those days, my grandmother and my father and my Aunt Patsy, they were the two kids. They went on the boat. The captain took his family on the boat. So my father, with the great story of my father, celebrated his first birthday in 1921 in Havana Harbor. And all the ships in the harbor figured out what it was. And they put all their salute flags up to my grandfather's ship for his son's first birthday.
Wow.
And that was always a long, great story in our family. So I wrote, when my father got sick, I wrote False Echoes about that.
Right, you know? Right.
So it started there, and then stories and the fascination of just reading about everything that was going on, and then going to Key West, of course, the connection from Key West, culturally, historically, from Key West to Havana predated Miami. You know, and that was, by that time the embargo was in place and everything was going on. But the stories told around town, everybody had a story about Cuba who'd been there when it was open. Yeah, and so it was always on everybody's mind. And Havana Daydreaming came of that, because the thing I read Peter Matheson's Far Tortuga, and it was kind of, I love that book, and I took a lot of that imagery, but I put it into a Cuban setting. And that's how I wrote Havana Daydreaming. Yeah. So, and then I got, just by surely being in Key West, I was transported. Jane and my wife and I went on we were almost shanghaied by Margot Hemingway and her crazy husband to go do a film with Bumby Hemingway and Margot. We sailed from Key West to Havana on the Western Union. And it was the same week that when Reagan was president, we invaded Grenada and were shooting Cubans. We were in Cuba. And it was a different, weird place. The Russians were still there then. So Still, though, I was fascinated by the charm of the people on the streets, and it was all I wanted it to be, and even in political situations. And so I, you know, anytime I got an opportunity to go, I got invited to go on a cultural exchange after that. Went and saw a baseball game.
Baltimore, I believe,
went
right?
to cover the Pope, was it John Paul the 23rd Pope, the Polish Pope. Went to cover him when he did a mass, and that was when Monica Lewinsky episode happened. And so I wound up staying in Cuba and going around the country with a Jesuit communist Santeria. You know, following the Pope.
We got to book him,
Cuba.
Dan Long.
So, and then recently I've got a great friend who's the CNN bureau chief there. When things started happening, I went down and spent a night. My daughter set up with some friends of hers there and just played with some great Cuban musicians. And then I did a show for the Marine security guards at the embassy before it was the embassy. But I knew things were moving at that time. And so, it'll be interesting to see what happens. It'll be, you know, there's a rush to it now because it's so strange and exotic. But it's such a big and beautiful place. And you get out, and Havana's one thing, but then you get Santiago and Cienfuegos and there's other beautiful places of it. In our lifetime, I was hoping I'd see it, and I'm glad I'm going to see it happen.
Were you down there busking, like, early? I saw some YouTube video. Were you just playing on the street or something? What do you play when you go down there?
I just play to see if people show up, but I knew because they could get the radio station from Key West, WKWF, you could get it on the Malecón. So they knew who I was. And after I did this cultural exchange, I'd just go out and play with these guys, you know, have a couple of drinks and go play with local bands, you know.
You sing in English or Spanish?
My Spanish is getting pretty good. I'd sing in both, but I can sing it now.
You
I
said that Malecón reminded you of Lakeshore Drive once.
It does. Sure. Malecón's kind of like Lakeshore Drive.
I was there in the 80s.
I can do the chorus of Margaritaville in Spanish.
Do you, can you?
Yeah. La gente dice que es mujer culpable. Yo soy que es mi maldito culpa.
Thank you. Todo, gracias, I
todo
guess.
Bien para toda la gente de español en Chicago esta noche.
Thank you.
I'm working on it.
I'm going to go to Easter Island.
Yes.
I know you have. Have you played there yet, or no, you want to play there?
Here's
though?
A quick story. Okay. I have a friend there named Joanne Von Tillich, who she is the archaeologist who runs the dig.
Okay.
So through her, and then through making the movie Hoot that we made, my driver and Hoot married a woman from Easter Island. Cheech was my driver, my Teamster driver. So they live between Lauderdale and Easter Island, so my music went back over there. So the Rapa Nui, the local indigenous tribe, I got word that the chief was like a fan. And then from Joanne Von Tillich that, you know, they wanted me to come and, like, when they do their cultural festival, be a guest, and they would let me sing amongst the statues. I was headed there to figure this thing out to see if it was actually true or not when I fell off the stage in Australia, because I was going to go from there to Moorea and I was going to fly back through Easter Island on my plane and go check it out. So I've never been able to do it. Now, I'm going again in like April of 16. I want to go because I got to get there. But you're going to go in the meantime. So
what do you want me to do for you?
I want you to check it out. I'll find out if Joanne is there, and I'll get in touch with her. But I want to find out if that is just urban rumor. In fact, they are Jimmy. If there are parrot heads on Easter Island, I want to know this.
All right, we'll get to the bottom of it.
All right,
two more things. I think I've always, besides the music, and I think there's a journalism connection, and I know the all the jazz fest I went to with Ed Bradley. God bless him. But one thing I know about the Ed stories, but tell us about your connection with Walter Cronkite.
Walter Cronkite?
Was it sailing? Was it news?
Growing up in the year of, the Nancy Griffith song, you know, I grew up in the 60s with Disney, Martin Luther, and Walter Cronkite, and I believed. It's a great line of song.
Yeah.
So I was one of those kids, but through coincidences, I wound up on Martha's Vineyard, and Huey Taylor, James's younger brother, was the captain on a boat that was owned by Jimmy Cagney, and Jimmy Cagney and Walter Cronkite would go sailing on this boat. So I met Walter through him, and I got to go out. And at the time, I'd rented Jimmy Cagney's old farmhouse on the vineyard. So two of my great heroes out there. So Walter and I just met through our love of sailing, and then we connected up in Australia when it was the America's Cup was lost, and we went down to get it back. So we were camped out, and he had a producer who was a guy named Jim Donaldson, who was a big fan of mine and introduced us. So we hung out, and we were on the boats together and kind of running around the America's Cup together. And from there, we kind of became big friends. And I would always go back and visit him in the vineyard when he'd invite me over, and we'd go sailing and just talk. Because to be in a lucky enough position to have Walter Cronkite on a boat with a couple of rum drinks in him was a pretty cool thing.
Were you with him when he – I've read stories. I don't know if it's true. I never asked you. Were you with him when he passed? Did you do a song?
I was there shortly before he passed, yeah. I was at his –
Did you sing?
I did sing to him, yeah. Me and Mickey Hart.
Really? What songs did you sing?
I think I sang Volcano, and he was playing along on a drum. Was up in his apartment. He was pretty much gone by then, but he was still. But I knew him from the Bohemian Grove, and the great thing was, I'll tell you, this will be when Ed Bradley called me one day, and he was in the height of 60 Minutes popularity, and he said, "I want to get an earring," and he said, "What do you think?" He said, Michael Jordan's got a earring. I said, yeah, but you're Ed Bradley. You're on 60 Minutes. He said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, you could get it. Maybe you could put a Band-Aid on your ear or something like that. He said, no, if I'm going to get it, I want people to see it. And I went, well, I said, we need to ask Walter. So Ed and I called Walter. And I said, we want to take you to lunch one day. So we're in New York. And we take him out, and he said, well, that'd be great to see you guys. I said, we got something to ask you. He said, you want to ask me? I said, no, we'll wait for lunch. So we take him to lunch, and we tell him the story, and we get to the point where Ed says, I want to get an earring. And at this time, Walter had been hanging out with Captain Tony down at Key West, I'd seen him down there, and so Ed told him that, and he said, well, I wouldn't. He said, that little thing, I don't know. Now we're thinking, okay, Walter's going to talk Ed out of this earring. He said, I don't know about that, Ed. He said, but if I was going to get one, but I'm not on the news anymore, I'd get one of those big old dangly ones.
That's great.
I told that story at the memorial for him that CBS gave, and I don't think anybody at CBS had ever heard that story, but that is an absolute true story. And then Ed got his earring.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. You've been so generous with your time. I know you got to go out to
dinner. It's a pleasure just to kind of to go back and run down this reverse track on this song line. It's been good.
It's been great.
Thank you for being such a part of it. You were a great help to me along the way, and I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Can you sign us off with a little bit of an intro to we're going to play the Wrigley Field version of City of New Orleans. Just set that up for us.
Yeah.
You can do my work for me here.
yeah, that was when we played Wrigley Field. I mean, there was one you can check off the list. And the weird thing was, it was right when the hurricane was hitting, Katrina was hitting New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. So your lifetime dream to play Wrigley Field, which is we'd play two nights there. On the second night, the hurricane had hit. So my attention was, you have to, those are those moments where, things are happening, but you got to keep your mind on the show. And so at the last minute, I told Mac, I said, let's go up into the bleachers and play City of New Orleans for everybody down home. And it was a very emotional moment to do it. I almost didn't get through the song.
I'll never forget it. So we're going to sign off with a little bit of City of New Orleans. Thank you again, Mr. Buffett.
Thank you, Mr. Hoekstra.
Illinois Central Monday morning train. 15 cars and 15 restless riders. 3 conductors and 25 sacks of mail. All along the southbound Odyssey, the train pulls out from Kansas.